Hello and welcome to another edition of the East Atlantic podcast series of Sea Control for the Phoenix Think Tank and SIMSEC, the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Alexander Clark and I have the joyous job of hosting these ones, as you've heard in previous ones if you listen to them. If you haven't listened to them, I suggest you go and do so. They're all quite good. And this is another session in our monthly panel. And this evening we are joined again by Arrigo Velliconia, Paul Fisher, and Chris Stockdale-Garbutt. Now, we'll be discussing this evening maritime security issue, whether multinational cooperation is the future for strategic defense, basically, and security, or whether nations should pursue a more solitary, self-sufficient model. I have a deep feeling already, before we even begin this, that this will lead into probably at least one more, if not two more, podcasts on this issue. So, look forward to what is probably round one.
Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SIMSEC Next World blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SIMSEC membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership. To get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And gentlemen, would you like to introduce yourselves and any websites you're affiliated with or whatever you're doing? So let's start off with Paul.
Good evening. Paul Fisher. I'm a contributor to the Phoenix Think Tank, and I'm very interested in maritime and naval futures.
Chris?
Hello, my name is Christopher John Sotogovic, and I'm part of the member of the Phoenix Think Tank, and I'm associate editor with SIMSEC.
And of course, Arrigo.
I am Arrigo Velliconia from Italy. I am also a contributor to the Phoenix Think Tank and a PhD from King's College London.
Well, actually, the poor boy had to suffer by being my colleague while doing his PhD. The counselling sessions, I hear, are still ongoing and hopefully will prove beneficial in the future to helping him get over that traumatic experience. Right then, I'm of course Alexander Clark. I am on British Naval History, where I've been doing a lovely series on Soviet Navy and the Royal Navy's reaction to them. I am on the Phoenix Think Tank, and where I have been contributing for years, for some reason. I'm still not quite sure how I got to do it for free. I keep meaning to put in a bill, but it never works. And of course I do my own blog when I can actually remember to upload something called Amphibious Necessity. And tonight, as I said, we are discussing maritime security and whether multinational cooperation is the future of it. So let's start off with a simple question, shall we? What areas are best for multinational cooperation, do we think? Who wants to go first? Paul.
I thought about this this afternoon, and as we're talking about the North Atlantic, and probably more weighted in this case towards the Eastern Atlantic, I thought, well, you know, what does the future hold in this area? Just because we need some sort of context for this. And the traditional sort of NATO areas have been Eastern Atlantic and Mediterranean, and I just wonder, as time has moved on, the Cold War ended a long time ago now, NATO is still here, there is embedded in that, obviously, complete multinational cooperation, especially, well, now, probably more in focus because of what's happening in Central Europe. But I sort of tried to boil it down, thinking about the maritime aspect, to three areas. One, these are in no order of priority, but one distinct area is clearly the Mediterranean, clearly defined, if you like, what was always considered to be the southern sort of region, southern flank of the European NATO area, the Eastern Atlantic, which of course was important in terms of providing the linkage to the other side of the Atlantic. But now I think there's an added focus with the sea area to the north of us, the Arctic, the polar areas. And so I started to look at it from that point of view. Three broad areas, all obviously connected. And I think there is a good basis of sort of looking at the cooperation almost sort of sub-regionally across those areas, and I would advocate, why change something that works? Why break something that's not broken? But refocusing the multinational cooperation in the maritime arena centered upon those three areas. And I'll just go on a little bit, because I think they sort of semi-separate out. There are particular problems in the Mediterranean, mainly, I would suggest today, associated with the North African area and the problems of mass movement of peoples. I think it borders onto the Middle East, which is clearly an area in its own right, but it borders over there. It also borders to the north into what are becoming contentious areas, Black Sea and so forth. So that's one area. And the polar area, I think, is characterized by the rise of its importance economically. And, of course, its expansion in terms of the fact that the ice cap is melting. So there is actually more usable sea space. And I think that's a significant issue for the future. And also what's happening in terms of people planting flags on various bits of land and so on. And then the Eastern Atlantic, I think, hasn't necessarily changed.
And occasionally on the ocean floor with the flags.
Exactly.
If you're the Russians with mini subs.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where I started thinking about it. I'll see what people's reaction is to that.
Chris Sirigo, who'd like to go next? Chris, you're doing the best facial expressions.
Thanks, that's got to qualify me, isn't it? No, I think a lot of what Paul said is highly important and definitely relevant to the debate. I mean, as a naval officer, he's obviously got far more experience and insight into this than I have. But from my side, what I'm sort of studying and looking at, I think multinational cooperation has got to be an expanding issue and a bigger issue to protect assets and the regions Paul said. I mean, as well as economic factors, but as well as to combat sort of piracy in sort of the Indian Ocean off the coast of Somalia, I think it has to be more relevant. I think NATO could be a big driving force for that, probably more so than it is currently. So I think it's a rising issue.
Okay, Arrigo.
I think I agree with Paul about the geographical area and also with Chris about specific mission area, like patrol, maritime control. Those hybrid missions that are not really war-fighting mission, but require war-fighting assets, are usually the best area where you can do multinational cooperation, because you are not stressing too much your command and control, and in the end you need more and more vessel to cover more and more sea space. Mm. And in this area, I think the two extreme, the Arctic Ocean, Mediterranean, and the southern part of the world, are probably a better arena than the East Atlantic, where the main mission is, just in case, major war fighting to keep the Russian out, keep something go bad.
I would say, when I keep thinking about it, the one thing that keeps coming to my mind is not just the areas, but whether different types of cooperation will fit different areas. In some areas, do the nations involved need to be able to do sort of provide a naval equivalent of a self-sufficient brigade, with all their assets combined, so they can mate together in sort of a task force as each their own task groups. In other areas, is it better if they specialise in certain areas, so they meet together in a sort of multinational force together? And I think that is actually, to an extent, I look at it from a logistical perspective when I keep looking at that one. In the areas where there is easier logistics in terms of there are more bases around that logistics can be drawn from, so it's easier to support a mixed force, one makes more sense. Whereas I find when you're looking at the longer distance, especially when you consider the difficulties with getting nations to not only work together and build these multinational forces and work in this way in this cooperation, but from the logistics perspective, to make it truly work, they need to start procuring together. And as we all know, that goes one of two ways. It either fails or it turns into a multi-billion pound project which is overrun and problematic, and no one's quite sure if it's actually got any use anymore. We're all crossing fingers it does turn out to be useful, but, you know, no one's quite sure. So, anyone want to continue from these points?
Well, yeah, I'm coming on this sort of idea of geographic specialisation. I mean, especially with regard to logistical support to operations, I think it would be, in my view, I mean, I'm being really sort of rather facile about it, but it would be better to employ a Norwegian frigate in the polar area than in the Mediterranean. That, just using that as a very simple bit of, and similarly, an Italian frigate employed near Spitsbergen might, you know, I mean, it can be done. There's no reason why it can't be. But in terms of the practicalities and economies, it would be better if the Norwegian were in the north and the Italian were in the south. I mean, putting that very simply. So operational support, I think logistics support is important in terms of focusing the effort. Now, I'm not saying it's exclusive. The UK is almost a peculiar example in the sense that it's the only major island off of Europe, and it's uniquely positioned right in the Atlantic there. And so clearly there's a role, you know, in terms of area of main specialization would be in the Atlantic, but sort of going north, going south, as it were. So I think that's one aspect, the operational logistics. I think there's a whole new subject about the bigger issue of materiel and procurement, which we can look at. I think they're two separate things in a sense.
I have to say, I was actually thinking at a slightly similar level, but a different level for that. I was thinking actually more in terms of if you're operating in the North Atlantic and that sort of expanse and going further north to the Poland regions, it's better almost if the task group, I would be thinking, if it was from mainly one navy, or in fact possibly wholly from one navy, because in terms of supporting at that range, whereas in the Mediterranean, where there are bases tend to be closer, if you have a mixed force and then there's a, let's say, something breaks on one of the ships, not even war damage, but just something goes wrong mechanically, which, as we all know, whilst they spend so much money, there is this old rule that called Murphy's Law, which, if people have heard about, is something can go wrong when you really need it. More often than not, it does seem to go wrong, and they don't have the spare parts, then it's easier for them to probably get a spare part in the Mediterranean than it is in the middle of North Atlantic. Or certainly easier for them to access where they can get the spare part. And that's more sort of my thinking, the idea of supporting these forces, these multinational forces. Because every time I look at the big Cobra deployments the British are doing, and we're doing another one that's coming up, 2014. And I hope I'm calling the right thing with Cobra. I think it's the right thing, isn't it? And they're going around. They've already announced there is probably going to be a French destroyer taking part. There's probably going to be going around the world. Now, that's a great thing for going around the world and the French destroyer coming. But if a problem, if that French destroyer has a part go wrong with it, when it's on the other side of the world and the only ships it's with are British ships, what are the odds of them having the spare part for it?
Well, I think there are, this is a, I mean, it's a well-worn subject, this. I think this is where there's a bit of a linkage between the bigger materiel procurement issue at one side, and then the, what I call operational support at the other. Now, all the basics, fuel, all that sort of stuff, food, everything that's consumable, there is not a problem at sea. It is completely interoperable, and that's mainly as a result of NATO standardization, which is a great success. The spare parts issue is certainly there. However, that's not exclusive. There are a lot of things which are common. So I think it needs to be addressed at two levels. I think day to day, I'm just saying that logistically, it would be better to, and I don't think it, let me split this out. Moving on to a new subject, which I'll come back to that first point. Task group composition and specialization of capability in the maritime area is generally not a problem. I can give many, many examples, even in specialist areas like, mine hunting, where, different classes of mine hunter can operationally work together without any real problem. 2, 3, 4 nations, and it's been done many times, in distant areas like the Gulf, for instance. So I don't think there's a problem about capability mixes in terms of task groups, and I don't think there's a problem in terms of command and control in task groups. I don't think any of that is a problem in the maritime arena. I think on the land, it is more of a problem, but that's not what we're talking about. So the big issue here for me separates out to the strategic issue of the procurement and materiel. If you see what I mean, I think all the rest of it can be handled, if you like, with, to a large extent with what we've got and, you know, what we're about to get. I think if you really want to make strides in terms of, as I think it was Origo mentioned, numbers of vessels, you need to bring about efficiencies in procurement such that you can afford more numerous, replications of various vessels and so forth. And I think there is a very big issue of, which goes outside the defense area, of an industrial policy and a political will to get more out of what we're spending at the moment. And that will come down to some pretty major decisions about how nations procure together. Sorry, I've spoken for too long.
Don't mind that. I think I'm going to go to Arrigo first, because Chris looks like he's contemplative. So I think he's still thinking on his, germinating on his idea. So I'll go to Arrigo.
Okay. I think some of the points were quite good, but they need some more discussion. Like, you, Alex pointed out about the French destroyer going in the cover deployment. But France has a worldwide link of base. Djibouti, they have a Réunion, Mayotte. It's more or less like UK.
Yeah.
Italy as some forward deployed naval depot to deploy to sustain ship in operation. But once is looking at those single poor mission, like going around the world doing a specific single task, but those are nice for the media, nice for your CV, nice for propaganda, but it's not what integration means every day. I think what integration is more about standing naval force from NATO, standing naval force Atlantic, standing naval force Mediterranean, or the big NATO European Union anti-piracy operation. And it's a bit different because you have almost a cloud of ship instead of a task force operating continuously together. And at this point, what you really need are numbers. Yeah. But then you have a problem. If you put so many numbers in the Indian Ocean fighting piracy, other mission at home, like Antarctic Patrol, Mediterranean Patrol, Atlantic Patrol, break down, and then you have to send Italian ship patrolling the Atlantic, UK ship patrolling with an Italian ship the Mediterranean, because the other Italian ship are above in another around the world in another mission. One of the problem of integration is we are not doing integration as a policy. We are doing integration because our navy are too small to do their own mission alone. And procurement is good for planned cooperation. In this case, I think we are doing cooperation on the spot because we are under-procured and understaffed.
It's a sort of stopgap.
Yeah.
Chris?
Well, I'd just like to sort of build on what Rico and Paul said. I agree with a lot of what Rico said. I think he's made some very good points. But the thing that strikes me from both of hearing you all speak, actually, is that I think we need more instances of this cooperation, not necessarily to combat or to counter anything, but just standardized exercises conducted by fleets on a fairly regular basis so that problems can be met and ironed out that when it's needed, it can be adequately and properly addressed. I think in the instance of the first Gulf War, occurred, that sort of, in many respects, showed how all that training and preparation had paid off, and everyone sort of went fairly, sure, Paul will correct me if I'm wrong, but fairly smoothly. Yeah. And I think if for future instance, I think we don't need any more of this ad hoc sort of coming together to meet an immediate crisis. We just need to sort of prepare in advance.
Well, it's one of the things I find interesting is that as a standard, the Royal Navy provides a single warship. Well, it's supposed to provide a warship to the NATO Response Force Maritime Group 1. Although, actually, since apparently, and I haven't seen any things which have countered this, is that we actually haven't provided such a ship since 2012 because they've been overcommitted. And that's exactly the sort of training and integration you need to help with the multinational cooperation.
Exactly.
Although, to be fair, we're also taking quite an active part in the various combined task forces and Operation Lanta and all these things. The fact is that to do those emergency missions, to do those contingency operations, security operations, which have come up, we've had to sacrifice what was our standing commitment. And I remember, it wasn't that long ago, I'm sure when I was a young lad, God, that makes me sound old, but when I was a young lad, not many years ago now, I remember watching a group come into Portsmouth, which was the NATO Maritime Standing Group. They were coming into Portsmouth to visit, and there were three Royal Navy warships as part of that group. And how is it we've gone from being able to provide three in the space of my lifetime, and I'm not that old, I'm not 30, to now we can't provide any because the forces are so small and so overcommitted. And I think I have to agree, it does need to be done. As Rigo says, we're doing it because of, as a stopgap measure, to fill in holes, which the navies realise and the governments must also realise are there because they're the ones making the arrangements for filling in the holes. But you can't paper over cracks forever.
Or not, as the case may be.
Well,
I need to prevention to deploy ad hoc task force instead of on relying on the standing naval force that were supposed to provide the core for such activities. Instead, because they are contingency operation and we don't want to be seen mobilizing NATO commit core unit, we are just doing ad hoc intervention every time. If you look at the US practice, instead of using the unit created and task organized for a specific mission, they just make ad hoc formation, because it seems if you mobilize a NATO full international group, NATO is going to war. And politically, we don't want to face this price.
Yes, which of course explains the joy of Somalian pirates.
Yeah.
Chris, there was a definite eye-rolling there, so I'm sure you've got something to add.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the US and the deployment of US fleets, you have to remember that they do come from a single military body, and they are all interchangeable, their officers are interchangeable, and to some extent I suppose the ships are too. But when you look at the NATO, obviously you have cultural differences, you have military differences, capabilities, and all sorts of things. And while it might look aggressive, I think unless if a situation arises where you can't immediately rely on the Americans to respond, you need to sort of have your own contingency plan in place. And I don't think NATO can just sort of just sit back and ignore its maritime commitments.
But this debate is... Technically, I don't see any problems whichever way you want to use, configure, or operate. It to me, as a professional naval officer, the mechanisms are all in place to deal with it. This is essentially a political question, which is what our ego has and Chris have both alluded to. It is not a military problem, this. And I can be really blunt about that. It is not a technical military issue. Everything, the toolkit is there. It is a political issue to, as Arrigo quite rightly says, he's articulated very well, the reason why the standing forces are not used to deal with sort of problems as they come up, like piracy. Because if the political, and remember, NATO is primarily a political alliance. It is not primarily a military alliance. Having worked there, I know that if you ask a politician or an ambassador who works in NATO, they will say it is a political alliance. The military is one part of it. And this is something that military people who haven't worked in the NATO arena, especially at headquarters level, don't see, because they only see the operational stuff. So I go back. I think Arrigo is absolutely right. The reason, and it is quite clear, the reason why standing forces of whatever capability they are not used are because to get authority to use them is a political decision. It's very simple. The military command chain in NATO will not act unless it is tasked to do so by the North Atlantic Council, which is the meeting of ultimately heads of state government or at day-to-day level the ambassadors from each nation to NATO. And Chris is right that in that sense that, you know, I know where this is going. You see, this is going to say, if you really want to do it properly, you need a unified military force, which the Americans have got.
Or,
and that's the point that Chris is making, and they have. That's a fact. Their political, their line of command, if you like, is president to Foxhole. It's very simple. And they have this, because they have scale of their forces, this is where their strength lies.
Yes, I do want. I have to say, I.
It's unpalatable.
That is
it's
one
unpalatable.
Of those things, which is, I have to say, it's probably going to be leading on to the future podcast.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm saying. I'm trying to keep it absolutely neutral. But I mean,
one, yes.
I want to emphasise that militarily, navally, or there aren't any technical issues. But yeah, there are things that you need to sort out, but it's all housekeeping. It's to do with political direction, and that is the nub of this issue.
I have to say, I also think, to an extent, there's almost a schizophrenic attitude to Combined Forces, because how often do you hear, oh yes, we can cut this part of a piece of equipment because our allies have this, so we will work together. And then when it comes time for the operations to happen, either the allies don't turn up or the allies aren't asked. And I always remember this. There was a story told to me about the Falklands War. The reason the Royal Navy had been told it didn't need to get airborne early warning was because the Americans would always be around to provide it. And of course, in the Falklands War, they weren't. And so the whole basis of which the Harrier had been going to be able to work as an interceptor, to get up airborne and get in position in time, wasn't possible. And so we had all these pickets and all these things, and this is what happens. We have to sort of... I think I'm of the persuasion, when it comes to multinational corporations, especially when you're looking at nations which are looking at maybe taking it to longer range operations, that maybe the self-contained brigade approach, or the self-contained task group approach, that can look after itself and form part of the task force, is an easier option and a safer option long term for a nation to do, because then if it needs to just deploy its own brigade or its own task group, it can do it without worrying about it being dependent upon others. But the trouble is, that is expensive, isn't it?
I was going to say, actually,
commitment.
Well, no, I think the first thing is it's unaffordable. It's as blunt as that. It is unaffordable. Because, politically, across Europe, people are not prepared to spend the money. I come back to this. There are no technical problems here. This is a political issue. Yes, it's great, you know, which nations in Europe can deploy a carrier battle group? Nobody. The French have got the only carrier in Europe that's working at the moment of that scale. They have not got the forces to run it 365 days a year, because one can't do that. It can be available for short packages of time. And if you look at the other nations, I mean, the UK now has 19 escorts, of which 6 are under maintenance permanently. Yes. Now, the UK is supposed to be a relatively large maritime power. It's not. And these are the political realities which you've got to be faced up to. And I'm afraid this is pointing out, desperately not trying to go there. There needs to be, if you know, to scale up, you need to bring together a more permanent agglomeration of forces. Yeah, which nation in Europe can deploy and support a brigade of amphibious infantry, or in the UK's case, Royal Marines? Nobody.
Well,
no, the UK had the biggest force. And even then, it used to be the UK Dutch force when it was properly constituted during the height of the Cold War. It is not, the capability is not there because it's become unaffordable. The reasons why it's become unaffordable are a separate issue. But the fact is today, I mean, I don't know the size of many of the, I mean, I know the French Navy is certainly not up to doing it. I mean, let's take a Navy like, and I'm going to use extremes now. Let's look at the Norwegian Navy. How many frigates have they got?
It's
4 or 5. I mean, I don't know.
I'm trying to remember from the.
Do you see where I'm
head,
coming from? No, but it doesn't actually matter what the figures are. What I'm saying is that This is a crucial issue, and it's being raised right in the beginning by Arrigo, the numbers game. And to be able to constitute balanced maritime forces in reality at sea, you need numbers, and you need numbers of, in some cases, specialist forces, not so specialist, and so on. And but what has happened in Europe is that we have not got the the critical mass to do that.
Norwegian Navy has five frigates of the Fridtjofn Nansen class.
Right. So they've
which
probably
I
got.
Which I have to admit, I looked up on Wikipedia because I couldn't remember off the top of my head.
No, that's all right. But I mean, they can probably field at any one time on that basis between two and three.
Mm-hmm.
Well, support ship. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you can just go from there. I mean, it's just not a runner. And even during the Cold War, when, you know, there was a degree of specialization because the UK used to provide totally UK forces, supplemented with others, but it could provide the ASW striking force to support the American striking fleet. And so we did specialize. Even then, we specialized in anti-submarine warfare operations, and we provided the American strategic striking force with its anti-submarine warfare protection.
Comes down to it, and this is something I've often wondered when I've looked at the Queen Elizabeth class, and I'm actually a supporter of them because I like them as carriers. I like that size of a ship because it does present, for going around the world, a very useful asset. But one does sometimes wonder, when one's thinking about it, whether or not the better solution would have been to go for three 45,000-ton LHDs, which could do the strike carrier role with a ski jump fitted on at a push with in the Vistal version, as we are going to anyway with the Queen Elizabeth. But then we'd have had a third carrier. We'd have been able to, the third ship, so we'd have always had, we'd have had one usually available for amphibious task group operations, and one usually available for carrier operations, so we'd usually have had, hopefully, two available.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would have been more sense, but instead we've gone for these two larger assets, which are very capable ships, but as you've pointed out, with one vessel, you can't maintain it all the time. You also can't maintain it all the time with two. And with three carriers, if the French do eventually replace Charles de Gaulle, because it is going to be needed to replace at some point, with three carriers between the European navies, yes, they can guarantee a carrier battle group will probably be available for Europe, but let's be honest, even if there is a carrier battle group available, what is the likelihood of, let's say, if the Falklands are invaded by Argentina again, bring up that one, which I know some people will criticise for me bringing up, but it's a thing. Will the French send their carrier down to help the British regain the Falklands?
Well, we have an historical precedent.
Yes,
and it's not really good.
No, it wasn't.
Several years ago when Morocco invaded a tiny, tiny, tiny Spanish island, Madrid asked for European support. European Union said, no, it's just a Spanish matter. So no European standing naval force was activated, despite, I think, a couple of agreements to do so, and the Spanish did everything by themselves.
That's right.
It's still not the Falkland. It's just in front of the coast of Spain.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
Mm. Chris? Mm.
Well, it comes down to sort of political relations again, doesn't it?
Mm.
How willing these nations are to support others. And again, I think it all comes down to further integration, further cooperation, and sort of more sort of knowledge of capabilities and commitments and things.
Mm.
And the trouble is with that is that, as Paul says, because it's not just NATO where the politics plays. We can do the military integration, we can do the military cooperation. And I know this is going into what will probably be the main topic of the next podcast, but hey, if we end up going there, we end up going there and this ends up being an extra long podcast. Instead of an hour and a half. The question is, would they actually, even if they did that level of military integration, that level, would they actually go to war when it wasn't in their interest? Would they actually act when it wasn't in their national interest? How can you force someone to deploy military forces when they don't want to? You can't. So in the end, you say integrate and to build the economies of scale and have this larger force, which on paper would be very strong and would work. But the only way you get round it at some point that it will actually work and like that is if you end up saying, well, no, instead of you actually wearing your national badge, if you're going to have to wear a different badge and, you know, all answer to a different government almost. And you've got countries going, right, then we're going to have to disband our armed forces and integrate them into one armed forces. And would any of them do that?
I think we are still too far away from this point. If we are not even activating the standing naval force for specific NATO and European Union agreed mission, who are not even combat mission, but just patrol mission, or we can go to activate a full strike task force for a real war fighting mission.
No.
I agree with you, Arrigo. I think that the mechanism to do something in a coordinated way is in place in NATO. The fact that it isn't used is a measure of how far away we are culturally and every other way to actually achieving any further integration. I think that's a statement of how things are. I mean, I think that's an absolutely, you know, it's a real touchstone with reality, that. I agree. So then the question is, okay, so we can't do that. So the first question is there any point in, I'm not trying to pour cold water on this, is there any point in going any further? Well, of course there always is, because it's worthy of debate. But I think knowing the problems of that, and you can then say, well, then why is NATO not prepared even to take that small step? I mean, that's a good starting point as to what the blocker is.
Chris, what do you think? And if you want to go down the European national nation superstate route, go on.
Well, no, not at all, really. But I just like to say what you said to begin with, Paul. I do think there is a point to this.
I think it is,
as you said. I think it is important. But maybe from a practical point of view, it is difficult to see in what respect. I mean, obviously it's good that everyone cooperates, but obviously it's not been enacted as such. I think maybe NATO as a body has to take a stand on in outlining in what circumstances it can deploy and sort of set guidelines, really.
We have guidelines, but we never follow them.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the problem, yeah.
And that is the nub of the whole... I think it's the nub of the whole issue, really, is that with multinational corporation, it works when the countries want to follow it and want to work. There are the mechanisms in place already, that it's an extent you don't need to almost do any more, because as Paul said, the mechanisms are in place. It's just using them. But also, it's a case of you can't rely on them as a country. You would, yes, using them is something that would probably make them more reliable if they were used more often, but all these countries, every country, I think, on, you know, in Europe, can think of occasions when either it hasn't been supported at all when it's needed those mechanisms to activate, or hasn't been supported as much as it would really needed to be supported when those mechanisms were needed to be activated. You know, of course you brought up the Falklands War, but there have been other involvements since, and there's the fact that the Cod War was fought between Royal Navy frigates and Icelandic fishery protection vessels. Not, you know, our NATO allies didn't come and help. There was no American carrier battle group deployed to back us up, which we could have used. to deal with the irate fisherman from Iceland.
No, but I mean, I'm going to be a bit controversial now. I like being controversial anyway.
We know, Paul. I'm going to
throw in. It's a completely, well, it isn't non-maritime because, well, yes, it is. It's a non-maritime theatre. And I mean, here is an example which really skewers the argument that we've been sort of evolving about NATO cooperation. And the word, it's the A word. Afghanistan.
Yes.
And this, you see, we're our own worst enemies. I joke with people in a very vicious way when I say, is there anywhere further away from the sea and specifically the North Atlantic than a place called Afghanistan? And I'm sorry, this is where, and this is, I'm going to be purposely divisive about it. The only reason, and I put it this way, that NATO got involved in Afghanistan is because of the nation now that is saying that Europe should do more.
Mm.
And it completely pulls the carpet on the concept of why should European populations vote and support NATO practice, you know, established protocols and get their politicians to implement them when they were dragooned into supporting the Americans in their so-called war on terror in Afghanistan. It pulls the rug completely from a political moral point of view about the whole raison d'etre, and it's just an impossible circle to square, or square to circle, whichever way around it is. It's a real issue, which if you talk to the man in the street, they say, well, you know, why is NATO in Afghanistan? I can't answer the question, can you?
Well, I think I seem to remember someone at some briefing I got at King's talking about Taliban and nuclear weapons and Pakistan and Afghanistan. But I have to admit, by that point it had been going on for 3 hours and I was looking for a biscuit.
Yeah, well, exactly.
The first hour would be brilliant. The trouble is, it took so long to get to the interesting point. By the time it got to the interesting point, I was, by that point, hungry. It happens, I'm sorry. 3 hours and you've got biscuits on the sides and I'm not allowed to eat them. That's going to make me hungry. One thing I would say, though, and even in Afghanistan, is the rules of engagement and the difference between the forces deployed has been really quite interesting. There was that whole incident where a German company, I think, was repatriated to Germany because they'd taken part in a firefight and they were apparently emotional wrecks after or something. I seem to remember the chief of staff of the German army going on television and apologizing. But it just seems to me that to an extent, again, both sums up the good point in that they went together, for a multinational reason, they went together to go do Afghanistan, but also the problem with it. Because they went there, and some of them went there begrudgingly, and the level of what they did when they got there. And Arrigo's looking at me like he's about to say something.
Yeah, I think Afghanistan has two things. First of all, 3,500 people dead in 9/11. This created an emotional chaos to go. We have gone to Afghanistan because we had to show some kind of support for US. Article 5 was invoked. Article 5 was implemented by the NATO Council. I think only case in history. And we got involved in Afghanistan because at the time everyone wanted to go. The people in the street today told them, no, I don't want to go. If you recorded them to 12 years ago, yeah, we have to go to Afghanistan. The same people who are protesting against the war in Afghanistan were the own who were telling everyone else to go in Afghanistan and free the Afghan woman. Yeah. It was an extreme unlikely circumstance, and everyone was thinking, we are going, the Americans are doing all the EV fighting, and then we are just rebuilding the country. To a certain extent, it was an emotional thing. To another extent, it was, we are trying to get the most reward for helping the US at the minimum price. We got involved in a nightmare, but this is Murphy Law. And you can even say the same of Korea in 1950. Europe got involved quite strongly in Korea. French, Dutch, Belgian, British troop, Turkish troop, they did the heaviest fighting of the second half of the 20th century. I think the British Army has still to equal its casualty toll from the Battle of the Imjin River, even counting all Afghanistan, all Iraq, all Falkland, and all smaller New World. In certain cases, we are doing things, but I realize that it's much easier to get involved when there is a big piece of land to defend, some people to free from enemy oppression, than to get involved in maritime operation. To a certain extent, it's a paradox. Paul said, on maritime environment, we are really, really good at cooperating together. Everything is in place, and we can do quite well. But politically, we never do it. On the ground, land combat, we are Afghanistan, and also Korea, and other occasion, show we cannot really operate together, except in very specific environment. But still, it's much easier to get the political support to go to be involved in a land war, than to be involved in some kind of combined or maritime operation.
So the real joke of the matter is that it's called the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Well, there's that. But I also think that I agree with what Arrigo says. It is ironic that engagement in international waters or in the on the sea is inherently far less risky than getting bogged down, literally, in a land operation. One would think that politicians would like to say we're doing something in a relatively risk-free area. Because actually, A, nobody can see what's going on. B, there are no populations to for collateral damage. And three, you can withdraw very easily. I mean, actually, the risk of maritime conflict politically is very low compared to a land operation. But I think time has moved on, you see. This is why, when I started reflecting about this, one cannot obliterate the Afghanistan experience from the populations of the world. You cannot obliterate Iraq from the memory of the public. And this, I think, is the seismic change which has happened, along with problems of resourcing and all the rest of it. I think there is a really big political issue here that actually, can you really imagine, I'm looking at it from a UK point of view now, a government in the UK sanctioning land intervention anywhere in the world now? Can you actually envisage that happening? Even in defense of Latvia or Estonia. I mean, that is a very clear Article 5 thing. I mean, while I'm on my hobby horse, I think invoking Article 5 against a non-nation or non-national threat was stretching the bounds of credibility. Because NATO, Article 5 was all to do with another nation having a go at one of the NATO nations. And this is the problem with this whole concept, and it is a concept, it's a concept built on thin air, of war against terrorism. It is a meaningless concept, because terrorism is not an enemy in itself.
You know, it's the organisations.
And the organisations are very disparate, as we know, and they change, and they form, they disappear, they change colour, and all the rest of it. And I think this is the problem, that we're thinking in Cold War terms here. Article 5, I still think, is valid for Europe. I don't have any problem with that. It sits there. But what has happened is, because of America being the only superpower, that position has been abused to such an extent that it has undermined the basic treaties that America was a party to after the Second World War. I just do not think there is the public will to support things which are intellectually clearly flawed and partisan.
I have a feeling, and it's extreme scenarios, there are certain circumstances where, yes, land invasion intervention would be supported, i.e. if someone invaded Australia, we'd probably end up sending a brigade. I have a feeling much the same with South Africa, if they needed us, and possibly even India, again, if they actually needed us, although India doubtfully would need us, seeing as they have such a huge army, they frankly wouldn't need to bother with us.
I don't even think that's right.
Yeah. I'm just saying, these are nations which, if they were invaded, we would more than likely through bonds of shared culture, history, heritage, blood, would go and put our lives on the line for, and the British public would get behind and would support.
That's a very UK view, though. That is very much a post-Empire view.
But I'm also thinking, for France, they went and did the operation, oh, good Lord, I've forgotten the name of the country, but it's just recently, the one they've gone into.
Chad.
Ali.
Mali.
Mali.
Operation
I kept wanting to say a really strange name, and I knew it was wrong, Mali. They went in there, but even then, what really interested me was they needed a lot more support than they got. Britain made a big thing about us loaning them 2 transport aircraft to help them, of which one broke down. And it was a really big thing, but I seem to remember hearing, although this was never said publicly, so I might be completely wrong, that they requested 4 aircraft, but were told simply, we can give you 2, and we can only give you them for a certain amount of time, because that's all we have free.
Just remember, there was no altruism in France's intervention in
there
Mali.
There is never altruism in any intervention.
It's called uranium. I mean, you know, and most of France's electricity is generated from nuclear power stations. I mean, you know, we've got to be realistic about this.
These things matter, Paul.
They do, and I'm not
it's
objecting to it.
It's national interest, and to be honest, that's usually why countries are going to get involved. And to be honest, that's probably why no one's actually got really involved in the Syria mess, because whilst many people are happy to try and shout from the sidelines and offer advice and all that, actually getting involved, is it in their national interest? Is there anything in Syria in their national interest to get involved? There are people who are suffering, yes. But the time when we can mobilize our troops and nations and their forces to go to war for people suffering, I think reached a peak with Libya and has since then been on a drop down. Libya seemed to have a surge. People were suffering, we went in, we did a very quick operation, yay, that was good, everyone was happy. Now they're looking at the post-Libya experience and what's happened since that operation, and people are going, hang on, was that actually a right idea, did we do the right thing? And now Syria, of course, came along at the tail end, and the appetite just wasn't there.
Well, as we saw in the UK Parliament.
Yes.
Dramatically.
Although, to be fair, that was to an extent the opposition playing politics and thinking they were going to look really good doing it and actually making themselves look a bit stupid because they'd said they were going to support it and then suddenly changed their mind instead of embarrassing the Prime Minister, kind of made them look like they were wishy-washy. But I'm not getting into party politics here, as we all know my allegiances. Never use these podcasts of party politics. Right, Chris, you haven't spoken for a while and you look pensive.
Okay, thanks. At the risk of being controversial, I think we could be going off topic slightly. We seem to have mentioned a lot of non-maritime issues, but I think we have raised some very good points, and I think Paul's sort of comparison with Afghanistan was very interesting. I like that. It was good. Because I sort of studied Afghanistan during my master's, after my thesis, in detail, and I agreed with a lot of what you said. It was it's definitely a changing environment. And it's teaching us a lot. I think a lot of the lessons that have been worked up through Afghanistan could potentially, and I might get some comments on this, but be transferable in the maritime scenario as well. Because obviously it's still a multinational corporation, albeit land-centric rather than sea-based.
I always think it's worthwhile remembering with Afghanistan, whilst it is definitely a landlocked nation, all this, the very first troops put in there from the British were launched from HMS Illustrious in an amphibious operation. A very long-ranged helicopter-based amphibious operation, but an amphibious operation. And it's just like AL-4 is often forgotten about with Iraq. This fact, this amphibious assault is often forgotten, but that was the only way of providing those troops with sufficient mobility for that initial operation was by doing it from the amphibious vessels. And those are the very vessels which then the government a few years later turned around and said, we don't need this capability.
It's also worth noting, going to Afghanistan, that a lot of the provincial reconstruction teams are actually led and have been by naval officers. So they're obviously utilising their experience with working with other organisations and other nations in that capacity.
And, of course, who are usually the first responders every time there is a major hurricane or multinational disaster? Because when they turn up, let's be honest, when a warship turns up, it brings along a very large power generator, a helicopter, some medical facilities, some people who know how to use chainsaws, and quite a lot of radios. All of which are very useful in that sort of scenario.
Definitely.
Arrigo is now smiling at me, and I think he has an idea.
No, just say yes.
That's very Italian.
Yeah. No, the only thing is one element of naval support, because operation people easily forgot, is you don't only provide generator, supplies, helicopter, but also you get your home with you.
Secure base.
Creating more emergency on the ground.
Yeah, a lot of effort. You're right, Arrigo. A lot of effort in these operations goes into what's called force protection. And actually, it's a major, major overhead, the logistic and base and the force protection.
Just look at Camp Bastion. That is absolutely colossal. And even that base, the largest base Britain has in the world, and that was penetrated by some Afghans, and they managed to destroy some US Marine Corps Harriers.
And I remember in one case the Taliban have almost overwhelmed the perimeter until three Danish Leopard counterattacked at night and saved the day.
But of course you don't need tanks in a mountainous region like Afghanistan, do you, Arrigo?
Actually, tanks are useful everywhere.
Yeah, the amount of times you hear these things, and it comes back to maritime security, you hear people going, you don't need an air defense destroyer. And just going, why? Oh, we have fighters on our aircraft carrier. But what happens if missiles break through the perimeter? Well, then the point defense will take them. So you mean you're going to rely on the point defense if the aircraft fail? Wouldn't it be nice to have the area air defense destroyer vessel with you? Because then at least that gives, you can hit the missiles before, if you miss them, they will hit the ship. And it's sort of the maritime security of the cooperation, and we'll get back to the sort of this multinational cooperation theme. A nice one with the Danish Leopards. protecting a British base. That's very multinational. And I also used to find it quite funny with the amphibious task group, when it was the Dutch-British task group, that the Royal Marines were talking about maybe taking some light tanks from the Blues and Royals, and the Danish were going, yeah, here are Leopards. We're the smaller members and part of it, and we're just joining on the Dutch-British task group, but we're bringing Leopards. Okay, well, tonight has been the first round of what will probably be an ongoing discussion, and I can tell you already I have three sets of eyes staring at me going, we have more to discuss on this. So I'm sorry to wind it up so soon, but we do try to keep these to an hour in length, because otherwise, to be honest, Matthew, the very nice, very talented editor from SimSec, gets annoyed and starts sending angry faces to me on Skype, and I find it slightly worrying. So, in summary, multinational corporation, well, it's there. The capabilities are there. The ability to do it is in place. The trouble is, to me, and everyone else can disagree with me at will, the reality seems to be that nations might talk about it, they might think about it, they might even prepare for it. But they don't really do it when it comes to naval operations, because in the end they act as always has been and as various, mainly German philosophers would be very happy to hear, they act in their own interests. And for that I do mainly talk about the great Immanuel Kant, who is a very interesting philosopher to read and provides a very interesting framework. And I haven't actually talked about him much this evening because I reckon I'm going to be talking about him more in the future podcasts on this topic. So, that's my summary. Anyone else want to pitch in? Arrigo.
Can we say we can do integration, but the will to do is another question?
Yes.
I think so. Chris?
Yeah, I agree with Arrigo completely. Mm. I think there needs to be greater will to do these sort of operations. Yeah.
And Paul.
Yeah, I'd put it another way, but I totally agree with that. But I think that through NATO we have evolved the capability. In other words, we can do it. The technical capability is knowledge. Structures are in place. What is needed is the political will. Unity, leadership, vision to use that capability in a changed world.
And thank you. And I'm going to say thank you to Rigo, Paul and Chris for this evening. They have been, as always, brilliant. Before we go, any websites, anything you want to mention, any projects of others you want to give a shout out to our listeners, all two of them, plus their mums? Anyone? No projects?
Well, I would say
you want to help?
Well, I would say SimSec, of course. Centre for International Maritime Security. Definitely check that out. It's very good. Many more podcasts available.
Although, only a few more but with our dulcet tones on. Arrigo?
Of course.
Phoenix Think Tank?
Just the Phoenix.
Yeah, at the moment, yeah.
At the moment, yeah. Paul?
Yeah, I would herald Phoenix, and for those, and I'm going to be completely self-serving here and say that a friend of mine, Graham Edmonds, and I have written a paper which has appeared on the Phoenix website, highly controversial, very partisan, and it's meant to be thought-provoking. So,
and it is Graham, a very interesting read.
Right, thank you. Anyway. And there was a corresponding article in, what's it called, Warship International, which is also points to the Phoenix website. There's a sort of what I call a journalistic summary. I think it was in the April edition. And there's a follow-on article from a US perspective on the same subject in this edition this month.
Ooh.
written by an American academic.
All sounds good. Right. Well then, thank you very much, and have a lovely evening.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. However, the most important thing you can do for us is to tell all of your friends. We rely on you, the loyal listener, to get out the word and foster the discussion. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Oh, you thought I meant talking to you next week. Well, that's you. But we can see you. Don't worry about it. Just remember to tell all of your friends.